great day, and please be safe whatever you do.
This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. North Korea continued its barrage of weapons tests on Thursday, firing at least three missiles, including a suspected intercontinental ballistic missile that forced the Japanese government to issue evacuation alerts and temporarily halt trains. The launches are the latest in a series of North Korean weapons tests in recent months that have raised tensions in the region. They came a day after Pyongyang fired more than 20 missiles, the most it has ever fired in a single day. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma has that part of the story.
The Joint Chiefs of Staff say one of the missiles landed just 16 miles away from the rivals' sea border. Seoul quickly responded by launching its own projectiles. The launches came hours after the North threatened to use nuclear weapons to get the US and South Korea to pay the most horrible price in history, it says, in protest at ongoing military drills. But it views as an invasion rehearsal. The White House has maintained the US has no hostile intent towards North Korea, only working with allies to the North's nuclear ambitions. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The World Health Organization warned Wednesday that Ebola's arrival in the Uganda capital highlighted the high risk of further spread of the deadly virus, calling on neighboring countries to boost their preparedness. Since Uganda's health ministry first declared the outbreak on September 20th, the country has registered more than 150 confirmed and probable cases, including 64 deaths, according to the WHO. The particular strain now circulating in Uganda is known as the Sudan Ebola virus, for which there is currently no vaccine, although there are several candidate vaccines heading toward clinical trials. For more news, please join us at voanews.com. Via remote, this is VOA News. Ethiopia's government and leaders from the country's Tigray region agreed to a ceasefire Wednesday after a week of peace talks in South Africa. The ceasefire, if it holds, would halt a two-year civil war that has devastated much of northern Ethiopia. A ceasefire was previously reached in March, but the agreement collapsed in August. The war between the Ethiopian government and the Tigray People's Liberation Front began 2 years ago, with each party blaming the other for initiating the violence. The U.S. Federal Reserve is again raising its key rate to fight inflation. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
The Fed is hiking its key short-term rate a relatively hefty 0.75 point. It's the fourth straight increase of that magnitude and the sixth this year, all aimed at cooling the economy enough to slow inflation, which hit an 8.2% annual rate in September. The aggressive pace of the Fed hikes has triggered a surge in borrowing costs for many businesses and consumers and heightened the risk of a recession. The home market has been especially hard hit, with the average rate on a 30-year fixed mortgage topping 7% last week, according to Freddie Mac, more than double the rate a year ago. Ben Thomas, Washington.
6 days before the major midterm elections, President Joe Biden is imploring voters to save American democracy from former President Trump's supporters' election-denying lies and the violence he says they have inspired. Biden shined a spotlight on the ultra-MAGA Republicans, a reference to Donald Trump's Make America Great Again slogan, and mounting concern over political violence.
The extreme MAGA element of the Republican Party, which is a minority of that party, as I said earlier, but is this driving force, is trying to succeed where they failed in 2020, to suppress the right of voters and subvert the electoral system itself.
Wednesday night's speech comes a few days after a man seeking to kidnap House Speaker Nancy Pelosi severely injured her husband, Paul Pelosi, in their San Francisco home, and as physical threats have rattled members of Congress and election workers. The UN Security Council on Wednesday overwhelmingly rejected Russia's attempt to establish a commission to investigate its unfounded claims that Ukraine and the United States are carrying out military biological activities that violate the convention prohibiting the use of biological weapons. Russia only got support from China in the vote on its resolution, with the U.S., Britain, and France voting no, and 10 other council nations abstaining. For more news, join us at voanews.com or the VOA mobile app. I'm Michael Brown reporting by remote, VOA News.
Today is Thursday, November 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Ethiopia's government and Tigray region leaders agree to a ceasefire in South Africa.
Today is the beginning of a new dawn for Ethiopia, for the Horn of Africa, and indeed for Africa as a whole.
North Korea fires more than 20 missiles, including three, towards South Korean territory.
Air raid alarms blaring on South Korean television, warning residents to evacuate. North Korea's unprecedented missile barrage adds to its record high number of launches this year.
And former Israeli Prime Minister edging towards victory in national elections. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Ethiopia's government and leaders of the country's Tigray region agreed to a ceasefire Wednesday after a week of peace talks in South Africa. The ceasefire, if it holds, would halt a two-year civil war that has devastated much of northern Ethiopia. Linda Giftash reports from Pretoria.
A ceasefire has been declared between the Ethiopian government and the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF. Former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo, who mediated the talks led by the African Union, delivered the news Wednesday in the South African capital of Pretoria. Obasanjo congratulated both parties for agreeing to the cessation of hostilities, disarmament, as well as restoring humanitarian access to the country's northern region. The United Nations and United States were observers in the talks that began last week. The conflict between the Ethiopian government and TPLF began 2 years ago, with each party blaming the other for initiating the violence. The roots of the dispute stretch back nearly three decades. The TPLF dominated the country's ruling coalition until 2018, when it lost power on a national level. The current government, led by Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, has accused the TPLF of attempting to restore its national hold, while the TPLF accuses the government of trying to oppress Tigray, where the party retains a stronghold. Neither side has confirmed casualty figures, but academics say the conflict has killed hundreds of thousands of people, including many civilians. Humanitarian aid has largely been blocked from reaching the region, and the United Nations estimates that upwards of 5.2 million people in Tigray are dealing with extreme food insecurity. They also lack access to vital medicine and other resources. A ceasefire was previously called in March, but that agreement collapsed in August. Since then, international pressure has been mounting for the warring parties to silence the guns. Although a civil conflict, the effects have rippled throughout the Horn of Africa. Eritrean forces had entered Ethiopian territory to back the national government. Refugees fleeing the fighting spilled into neighboring countries like Sudan. The agreement is only the beginning of the peace process, says Obasanjo, and it will allow the devastated region to begin to rebuild. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Pretoria, South Africa.
U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price told reporters on Wednesday that the agreement between the Ethiopian government and regional forces from Tigray to cease hostilities represents an important step for peace. He added that Washington will continue to engage to advance the peace agreement.
What we will have to see is follow through, and the United States will be there. We will be there to continue working with the African Union. They will continue to lead this process, but we will continue to engage directly with the African Union, to engage with those in the region who are facilitating this dialogue, and to continue engaging the parties themselves. These discussions have provided an opportunity for a number of things. In the first instance, they provided an opportunity which we hope to see realized of a cessation of hostilities. We've invested so heavily in this process because we believe it's the most opportune and effective mechanism through which to achieve a cessation of hostilities, to help enable the delivery of much needed humanitarian assistance to the people of northern Ethiopia, people of Tigray. We hope and expect that will follow from today's announcement.
That's U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price. 6 days ahead of the U.S. midterm elections, President Joe Biden issued a fresh warning about the threats posed to the country's democracy, saying election deniers are putting America, unquote, the path to chaos, unquote. Details from VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman in Washington.
In a Wednesday evening address inside Washington's Union Station, President Biden said voters next week should ask whether the candidates on their ballots will accept the results of their own races, win or lose.
The answer to that question is vital, and in my opinion, it should be decisive. And the answer to that question hangs the future of the country we love so much and the fate of the democracy that has made so much possible for us.
In the 21-minute speech, Biden criticized his predecessor, Donald Trump, for continuing to make false claims about a stolen 2020 presidential election, saying that has fueled the dangerous rise of political violence and voter intimidation over the past 2 years. Some Republican lawmakers call Biden's concerns overblown and say his rhetoric is divisive and meant to divert attention from what they call the policy failures of the president and his Democratic Party. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
North Korea has continued its barrage of weapons tests, firing at least 3 missiles, including a suspected intercontinental ballistic missile that forced the Japanese government to issue evacuation alerts and temporarily halt trains. The launches on Thursday were the latest in a series of North Korean weapons tests in recent months that has raised tensions in the region. They came a day after Pyongyang fired more than 20 missiles, the most it has fired in a single day ever. The Japanese government initially said at least one of the missiles flew over its northern territory, but later reversed its assessment, saying there were no overflies. More from VOA's Bill Gallo in Seoul.
Air raid alarms blaring on South Korean television, warning residents to evacuate. North Korea's unprecedented missile barrage adds to its record-high number of launches this year. The launches happen so frequently that most South Korean residents barely notice. But on South Korea's Ulong Island, residents heard loud air raid alerts. Another North Korean missile landed south of the de facto sea border. Kong Shin-chul is the Director General of South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff. He says this is the first time since the division of the peninsula that a North Korean missile has landed south of the northern limit line. It is very rare, he says, and we can never tolerate it. In response, South Korean warplanes launched 3 missiles across the sea border. It's the first time since the 1950s for either country to take that step. On Wednesday, they both did. North Korea is upset at the United States and South Korea for conducting joint military drills. The North sees the exercises as provocations. Washington says the drills are defensive. Hundreds of warplanes are involved in the latest military drills, which run until Friday. Ankit Panda is with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He worries tensions could continue to spiral dangerously.
The spiral dynamic is that both sides will feel compelled to keep upping the ante. The North Koreans still have the nuclear test card to play, but I also worry that, you know, that won't be sufficient for them. This could be leading to a much more dangerous destination.
North Korea is also expected to continue its displays of military strength. With each side blaming the other for raising tensions, it's hard for now to see where the cycle ends. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul, South Korea.
Bill, thank you, Bill. Russia said on Wednesday it would renew its participation in an agreement allowing Ukraine to export grain via the Black Sea just 4 days after suspending its role in the deal. Louisa Nax of Reuters reports.
Russia is to resume participation in the Black Sea grain deal. That's according to the Defense Ministry on Wednesday. Moscow had suspended its involvement in the deal over the weekend, saying it could not guarantee safety for civilian ships following an attack on its Black Sea fleet. But the ministry said on Wednesday it had been able to obtain written guarantees from Kyiv, saying it would not use the humanitarian corridor or Ukrainian ports to conduct military operations against Russia. Moscow also thanked Turkey and the United Nations, who helped broker the deal, for their involvement. Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan said the deal would resume on Wednesday.
After the call we held yesterday with Vladimir Putin, Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu called our National Defense Minister, Hulusi Akar, and said that the grain transports will continue as previously agreed, as of 1200 today.
It comes a day after Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky called for stronger defenses for grain shipments. He said the world should respond firmly to any Russian attempts to disrupt the Black Sea corridor. The conflict in Ukraine has fueled food shortages and a cost of living crisis in many countries. The July deal aimed to tackle that by providing safe passage for vessels carrying grain and fertilizer exports. Ships had continued to export Ukrainian grain even while Russia withdrew cooperation, and a record volume moved on Monday. The deal's UN coordinator said he expects more loaded ships to leave Ukrainian ports on Thursday.
That's Louisa Nax of Reuters. Ahead of COP27 climate talks in Egyptian resort of Sharm el-Sheikh next week, there are concerns that Russia's invasion of Ukraine has reversed progress on tackling climate change. But as Henry Ridgewell reports, some say the war could have a positive impact in the longer run.
Russia's invasion of Ukraine has stoked global geopolitical tensions, and the destruction doesn't end on the battlefield. Progress in tackling climate change, forged at the COP26 summit in Glasgow last year, has taken a hit, says analyst Anthony Froggatt.
The development of coalitions and joint large coalitions, but also bilateral initiatives such as US and China proposing a new program of work to address climate change. And some of that goodwill has disappeared. And it's not just in terms of Russia. We see that China has pulled out of that arrangement with the US as a result of Taiwan. So across a number of areas, the geopolitics isn't so positive.
Scientists say the world cannot afford to let the Ukraine conflict distract from the climate emergency. Inga Andersson is the executive director of the United Nations Environment Programme.
We need to be able to deal with multiple crises. And the truth is that with the war in Ukraine and with the complexity around oil and gas supplies, there is an opportunity, and I say that with respect, there is a chance now to really invest in clean and green rather than to invest in hydrocarbon infrastructure. That's what the world needs to do right now.
The International Energy Agency said last week the war in Ukraine will hasten a green energy transition. IEA Executive Director Fatih Birol.
The government responses around the world given to this energy crisis promise to be that we are seeing a turning point in the history of energy, and this crisis indeed accelerates clean energy transitions.
Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
In other news, former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu appears to be edging towards victory in national elections, with nearly two-thirds of ballots showing that he and his ultra-nationalist and religious allies are poised to achieve a stable majority in the country's parliament. Votes were still being counted on Wednesday morning, and results were not final. But Israel was likely headed to one of its most right-wing governments, bolstered by a strong showing from the ultra-Zionist religious party, whose members used inflammatory anti-Arab and anti-LGBTQ rhetoric. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. In Turkey, the right of women to wear religious headscarves has once again become a subject of political debate. With elections less than a year away, the leaders of the country's main political parties are vowing to legally enshrine women's right to wear religious attire, an issue that for decades was at the center of a bitter political struggle. For VOA, Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
With presidential elections due by next June, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and the leader of the main opposition, CHP party, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, are vowing legally to enshrine women's right to wear religious headscarves. Some analysts say Erdogan's lifting of restrictions a decade ago on religious dress is one of his biggest achievements. One of those analysts is Emine Uçak, a journalist who wears a religious headscarf and writes for the news journal Perspective. She says the headscarf issue in Turkey was implemented within the framework of a law as a ban that prevented many women from participating in the public sphere and receiving education. That was how it was in the past. These women went through this trauma. There are still some who can't go back to their professions. Throughout the 1990s and early 2000s, students who wore headscarves were banned from attending universities, becoming lawyers or judges, or even members of parliament. The staunchly pro-secular CHP was a strong advocate of the ban, holding mass rallies, but is now calling for legislation to guarantee the right to wear the headscarf. Politics and law professor Ishtar Gözaydın has written several books on religious affairs in Turkey. She says the CHP move is significant.
I believe that CHP has luggage because of that, of those limitations, of those bannings, etc., etc. So a step like that I find very, very successful in the sense of embracing more of the society. That's a huge step.
The CHP shift comes as under Erdogan's two-decade rule, a generation grew up without such barriers. A conservative religious middle class also has emerged and prospered. Some analysts say they are now more concerned about the country's present economic woes of near triple-digit inflation than past religious debates. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
The new Ad Hoc Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, says he will use his position to advocate for the rights of people around the world, especially for the most vulnerable, powerless and repressed. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Human rights chief Volker Türk says he's been on a learning curve since he assumed his post September 8th, and much of what he has seen he does not like. He says he's taking up his functions at a time when the world is very divided and riven with political tensions. Türk says he worries about the deepening politicization and polarization in the world. He adds that the artificial dichotomy between, on the one hand, civil and political rights, and on the other, social, economic, and cultural rights is very harmful to people. He says he worries about the decline of multilateralism at this time when the world is emerging from the COVID-19 pandemic and is absorbing the consequences of Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
And when the world needs to be most united, we see that the world retracts in groupthink and in bloc mentality. And unfortunately, human rights is thrown into the vortex of these dynamics and has become a battlefield, which we cannot afford and human beings cannot afford.
And yet, he says, human rights violations continue unabated, often erupting into violence when people's grievances are not addressed. In just the last 2 weeks, he says, protest movements have been violently repressed in several countries, including Iran, Sudan, South Sudan, and Chad. Türk says working to overcome these grievances by addressing the reasons behind them is one of the big issues facing him as High Commissioner. He says he believes very much in advocacy, in pushing boundaries to advance the rights of people everywhere in the world.
I will speak out when we feel that our voice can make a difference, or when it is needed to amplify especially the voices of victims, and or to sound the alarm bell. I think that's very clear. That's the role of the High Commissioner, and that's an important role.
Türk notes he will use all the tools at his disposal to advance human rights globally. He says he has many available after working 30 years for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, lastly as Assistant High Commissioner for Protection. He says 30 years of living and breathing human rights in action in the defense of the most vulnerable people has prepared him well for the challenges ahead. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is Science in a Minute.
According to the National Science Foundation's NOAR lab, astronomers have spotted the biggest potentially dangerous asteroid in 8 years. The discovery of the 1.5-kilometer-wide 2022 AP7 is one of three near-Earth asteroids that have been found by scientists using the U.S. Department of Energy's Dark Energy Camera at NSF's Cerro Tololo Inter-American Observatory in Chile. The astronomers say the other two asteroids are safely circling the Sun in the same orbit as Earth. While most of the solar system's asteroids are located in the asteroid belt, there are a number of them residing between the Earth and the Sun. Since the glare of the Sun makes it difficult for scientists to spot these inner solar system asteroids, the astronomers had to make their observations during the brief amount of time available during twilight. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel. Changing of the guard in Latin America's largest country. Leftist candidate and former president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva narrowly defeated right-wing populist incumbent Jair Bolsonaro in one of Brazil's most hotly contested elections. How will former President Lula unite the highly polarized electorate? Two Latin American experts discuss the ramifications of Lula's victory in Brazil. Next on Encounter on The Voice of America.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me this weekend on Press Conference USA for a discussion of ongoing challenges to religious freedom with International Spokesperson for Jehovah's Witnesses, Paul Gillies. We'll discuss some examples of religious persecution from the past and present and how one organization has responded to restrictions and the banning of activities. Join us for PCUSA this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com. And check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA, and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Deadly Russian airstrikes using Iranian-made kamikaze drones are rocking cities in Ukraine, killing civilians and damaging residential buildings, power stations, sewage treatment plants, bridges, and playgrounds. State Department Deputy Spokesperson Vedant Patel warned that Russia's deepening alliance with Iran is something the entire world, especially those in the region, should view as a profound threat. In response, the United States, the United Kingdom, and France raised the issue of Iran's transfer of unmanned aerial vehicles, or UAVs, at a meeting of the UN Security Council. The United States expressed its grave concerns about Russia's acquisition of these UAVs from Iran in violation of the UN Security Council Resolution 2231, said State Department spokesperson Ned Price in a statement. The United States began warning in July that Iran was planning to transfer UAVs to Russia for use in Russia's brutal war against Ukraine, said spokesperson Price. And we now have abundant evidence that these UAVs are being used to strike Ukrainian civilians and critical civilian infrastructure. Iran has denied supplying weapons to Russia despite abundant evidence to the contrary. U.S. Mission to the United Nations spokesperson Nate Evans confirmed that there is ample evidence that Russia is using Iranian-made UAVs in cruel and deliberate attacks against the people of Ukraine, including against civilians and critical civilian infrastructure. By procuring these weapons in violation of UN Security Council resolutions, Russia continues to flout international law in its pursuit of a senseless and brutal war against Ukraine, he declared. As Iran continues to lie about providing weapons to Russia for use in Ukraine, the United States is committed to working with allies and partners to prevent the transfer of dangerous weaponry to Russia, said spokesperson Price. We will not hesitate to use our sanctions and other appropriate tools on all involved in these transfers. We will also continue to surge unprecedented security assistance to Ukraine, including air defense capabilities, so that Ukraine can defend itself from these weapons.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.